Government Innovation and Veterans will be in order. Today is Wednesday, January 19th, 2011. A few items on the agenda today. We're going to hear from Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board Overview and Office of Administrative Hearings Overview, some rulemaking presentations, and then we're going to deal with a confirmation here. So we're going to start here, and the first item on the agenda is an overview of the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board. Gary Goldsmith, our executive director, and I don't know if Jeff Sigerson will be with you at the table, sir. But all right, please introduce yourself, and we'll get underway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Gary Goldsmith, and as the chair noted, I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. My presentation today will be a high-level overview of the board, what we do, and why we exist. And I have provided a handout in three pages. You probably noticed that they're marked, I think, pages three and four, and then one without a page number. They're actually just excerpts from my notes, and I have to number my notes or I'll get mixed up. I'd like to cover, first of all, an introduction to the board, some facts and figures, which are on one of the pages of the handout. Talk about why we have a campaign finance board or why we have campaign finance regulation at all. And in doing that, hopefully I will be able to address one of the chair's questions, which is how does our agency contribute to the improvement of Minnesota and to the value, how do we provide value to the citizens of Minnesota? And then I will talk about innovation, how we run the board, and finally a little bit of discussion from a high-level view about public subsidy and the concept of public subsidy programs in general and what they cost, whether they provide value or not.
Mr. Goldsmith, one moment here. I'd just like the record to show that we do have a quorum at this time.
Okay.
Thank you.
The board operates a lot like a corporation with a board of directors and an executive staff and then other staff. And I'm the chief executive. I'd like to, at this point, introduce my assistant executive director, Jeff Sigerson. Jeff? And we're the two people that you will call most often if you have a technical or legal question, something more complicated than when is the next report due or what's the individual contribution limit. You've all had some involvement with the board because you're all elected here. You've all filed campaign finance reports. You all have registered principal campaign committees. You've all filed economic interest statements. And sometimes we forget why all of that happens. And the board was actually established in 1974, which was what we refer to as the Watergate era. I'm just watching my clock here so that I don't run too much over time. That was a time of big unregulated money in politics. There wasn't really such a thing as campaign finance regulation at that time. And the result of all of that money in politics led to corruption, or at least the appearance of corruption. And the federal government decided to take action and to regulate money in politics. Minnesota followed soon afterwards by forming what was then called the Minnesota State Ethics Commission. At that time, money in politics and the giving of large contributions often was treated as an ethics issue. That's not the case anymore, and in the 90s, the name of the board was changed to better reflect what it does and how it's perceived now, and that is its campaign finance and public disclosure regulation. We don't view violations of Chapter 10A as ethics violations anymore. That's really a misnomer. The board, which constitutes our board of directors, is six people. They have staggered four-year terms. They're all appointed by the governor. Because Governor Pawlenty served 8 years, he has all of the board members on our current board were appointed by Governor Pawlenty. But it's a bipartisan board, and most board members we find leave their partisan ideas at the door when they come into a board meeting. One of our goals is to provide fair and even-handed enforcement of the campaign finance laws, and that means ignoring any political inclinations we might have and also ignoring the politics of the people who appear before us. Unlike any other board or agency in the state government, our members are confirmed by both bodies of the legislature. So we will have anywhere between one and three members coming before the policy committee in the Senate, and each of you will have an opportunity to vote on those board members when they come for confirmation in the whole body. We have one member who was appointed by Governor Pawlenty late in the term, who will need confirmation. And there are two slots open for Governor Dayton, should he get those appointments made in time to be heard yet this session.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Goldsmith. So the governor has two appointments during this year's session. How many appointments then during the 4 years?
I will have to check at least three. The current appointment, the last appointment Governor Pawlenty made was for a term for a resigning member. That term expires in January of 2012. There are two members right now whose terms actually expired in January of this year, in fact, the first Monday of this month. Under our statute, those members can serve until their replacements are named, and they've agreed to serve on the board until their replacements are named. So two right now. One for sure in 2012, and I would have to check the grid to see if there are others coming up yet in the four-year term, but a minimum of three. I'd like to just briefly talk about the facts and figures. I've reproduced them on page three, but they're really nothing that you need to remember. But I want to give you sort of an idea of what the eight people in the campaign finance board do on a day-to-day basis. Most of what we do has to do with money in one way or another. It has to do with both the regulation of money and the disclosure of money. We have right now registered with the board 828 principal campaign committees, that's candidate committees, and actually there are probably about six more as of today because of the special election and a number of new people got into that election, some of whom will form candidate committees. We have more than 300 party units and 371 political committees and funds. Those are often referred to as PACs, although that's a shorthand. It's really a federal term. It's not used in Minnesota statutes. And then we have 24 of this new type of organization that was recognized by the legislature last year, the Independent Expenditure Organization. That type of entity can take corporate money without limit and use it, but it can only make independent expenditures. And if you remember the last election cycle, I don't know if any of you had independent expenditures made by these groups for or against you. Most of those expenditures were done in the gubernatorial race, both for and against the candidates in that race. We also have 1,337 lobbyists and 2,159 public officials. So we have more than 5,000 individual organizations or people who report to us and provide disclosure on some basis or another at least once a year and often more than once a year. The dollar amounts that pass through our system, and remember, each of these dollars has to be looked at by us, whether it comes in as a contribution or goes out as an expenditure, we review those dollars for compliance with campaign finance law. Looking at the dollars for the 2010 election, only up to the pre-general election report, which is really 2 weeks before the general election, $19 million in candidate contributions, $49 million in other contributions, so a total of $68 million in contributions coming into entities that we have to run through our system to make sure they're in compliance, $23 million in candidate expenditures, $49 million in others, so a total of $44 million in total expenditures, and then on top of that, about $12 million in independent expenditures. Luckily, and I shouldn't say luckily, it wasn't luck at all, but by planning, we are very technology-oriented, and so a lot of our work is done by computer and with computer assistance, although lots and lots of work still has to be done manually. But if it weren't for the technology advances that we've made over the last 4 years, we would be hard-pressed to do this work with the eight staff that we have. The next sheet that you have is just for you to keep for reference, but it's the mission and goals of the board, and I will talk a little bit more about why a campaign finance board in general in any state might exist as I go on, but I think the most important statement that I could make is in the board's mission. The mission is to promote public confidence in state government decision-making, and it does that through the development and administration of programs that are given to us by the legislature and statute. And I think every state that's looked at it, from the federal government in the 70s on down, has looked at this as the most important reason for campaign finance regulation and disclosure, is to promote public confidence in state government decision-making. The idea is that sunlight on money used in politics as somebody said a long time ago, is the best disinfectant. I think a better way of saying it is that people are confident in their elected officials if they know, because they can see on the internet, that those officials aren't unduly being influenced by any money of any kind. And Minnesota has a great system for doing that. And we have a hybrid system of limits on expenditures in most cases, limits on contributions, and a very powerful disclosure program. I might just mention that the goals are really three. Facilitate easier and more universal compliance. We do that primarily through education and outreach, including written materials. We found universally that compliance is voluntary when people know what they should do. In a very, very rare number of occasions, there's been intentional noncompliance, but that's certainly the exception rather than the rule. As I mentioned, we try to provide fair and consistent enforcement, and we try to help people become more informed about campaign finance issues, in particular, more informed about how finance affects their elected officials, because they can go right online and see it. There aren't any facts and figures, but I would like to think that part of our disclosure system is at least partially responsible for the confidence our citizens do have in elected officials, and that confidence is demonstrated by the fact that people still go out and vote in this state. They're not apathetic toward our elections. The chair asked, and it was already a topic of these presentations that I've been making to the various committees, how we innovate, how we are able to or look try to become more efficient to operate within our budget within budgets that we don't expect to increase. We won't be coming looking for more money, I can tell you that. And, in fact, budgets that very well may decrease. We're always looking for ways to become more efficient, and often that requires looking forward some period of time. For example, we're working on an electronic records transition now where we'll move from paper to electronic. It's more efficient for records management. There's less paper to buy and so on. But that's a process that's going to take us a few years. We have to develop policies and procedures and so on. Something that's a little more easily implemented is a transition of our telephone system from the old state system, which involved landlines from Quest, through what is the new model for state government, which is a voice over IP system that goes over the internet. Many state agencies have already made that transition, including the big agencies. There's an upfront investment. It could run as high as $10,000, but we've determined that that can be repaid in savings on our telephone bills over about 3.5 years. We've been saving for a couple of years through this biennium. In fact, to do that, we'll be able to implement that this year. But let me explain, too, that that's part of this, what's sometimes called the June bubble or the year-end bubble. Agencies like ours have to save over the whole biennium to do any kind of a project that might be an initiative that would take some kind of capital outlay. We don't buy replacement computers during the biennium because we don't know if we'll have enough money left at the end of the biennium. And we certainly couldn't do a program like this telephone replacement, which both gets us onto the state standard and is going to save money every year going forward. We couldn't do that at the beginning of a biennium because what would happen if something unexpected came up and we ran out of money by the end? We're also doing some reconfiguration in the front end of our office where we have some extra space that's not needed now that we don't have public members coming in to look at our documents because they're all on the internet. So technology eliminates the need for a lot of public space, and I'm going to try to reconfigure a couple of workstations there so that we can use interns and volunteers to help with things like scanning once we begin our electronic records program. If staff alone has to do that, it will take forever, and we're looking to provide a workspace so that we can get some free volunteer assistance to help us with that. We've used technology all along, and we'll continue to do so in ways that we can hopefully minimize our staff requirements or at least not increase them. And one of those the legislature passed last year, for those of you that were here and voted for it because it was passed by an overwhelming vote, that's the mandatory electronic filing for 2012 elections. It's mandatory, although waivers will be available to those who need them. But that's another forward-looking thing that in 2 or 4 years might allow us to reduce our staff if we need to do that. If we don't have to reduce staff, there are a lot of services that we're not providing that we'd like to be providing.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
I just have a brief question. How many of the
people so far do you think would be requesting waivers? It's got to be a pretty small amount, right?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, our experience has been that the percentage of users of the existing software, which we already produce and provide free and provide tech support as well, the percentage of users for newly formed committees or committees, say, formed in the last 4 years is high, whereas the percentage for committees that have existed 10 or 15 years is still relatively low. We do think that the number of waivers will be relatively low. We'll start working on a waiver process during this calendar year, so it's up and running, but we hope it will be low. But we're not going to force people to buy computers who don't have them or force people to get new treasurers who have treasurers that don't use computers. That will phase in over time by itself. Not everything can be done outside of the agency, we found. And in our agency, because we're completely data and technology driven, or not completely, but if we didn't have it, we simply couldn't function. One thing that we've determined after looking at it repeatedly is that the information technology services that are provided by our two technology staff just can't be moved outside of the office. We look at things that might be moved out. Those guys are busy all the time, every day. In fact, I had a compliment from a candidate who was having trouble with our software on the night of filings before the primary general election, and he actually told me he was getting responses from our tech staff at 11 o'clock at night. I didn't even know that. But that's the kind of support you just can't contract out. On the other hand, there are things that can be done better, and I think we've done them. I want to tell you about one, and it's really a legislative initiative with the Department of Administration. It's called the SMART Team, which stands for Small Agency Resource Teams. There are a lot of small agencies like ours, and small agencies typically don't have the number of staff that would be required to really be completely on top of all the state's human resources, policies, procedures, hiring, firing, and so on, let alone to enter all that information into the complicated state systems. Another area that agencies typically don't have expertise, although I think we're quite far ahead on this one, is purchasing policies and procedures and financial controls. The part that we don't have expertise in is how do you get that data into the state systems. The Department of Administration was funded for some extra staff to provide that transactional processing and expertise for small agencies, and we opted into that. It was part of what helped us lower our staff complement from 9 to 8. We had an office manager who did all of that, and with the advent of the SMART team, we were able to change our structure and cut from 9 staff down to 8. And the board strongly recommends that those SMART teams be continued into the future, and if not all small agencies are using them, it would be our recommendation that they do. Not only has it freed up some resources and allowed us to decrease our staff, but it's really increased our level of professionalism in those areas of HR and financial transaction processing. OET does a lot of great work also. The state email system is expertly run. No agency that I know of runs their own email system. They certainly shouldn't be, and it's cost-effective. OET also entered into an enterprise licensing agreement with Microsoft where for only $130 per staff member, we always have the most up-to-date version of Windows operating system, Windows Office, and all the Windows products. So that's a great savings to state agencies. I think that we will have some legislative recommendations, though they will mostly be before the policy committee because they're not budget-oriented. But I will say that they're designed to help us, again, to streamline our operations, at the same time to allow people to engage in campaign finance activities without always having to come under the jurisdiction of the board. For example, we would expect to be increasing thresholds, or we will recommend increasing thresholds for registration so that if a candidate goes out and spends a couple $100 trying to get the party's endorsement, under the current law, once you spend over $100, you have to register with the board. We're suggesting that that be increased to $250 so you can do some spending without getting under our jurisdiction. For political committees and funds, we'll be suggesting that level be even higher, particularly for independent expenditures so that the barber on Main Street can buy an ad in the local paper supporting a candidate without having to register with the campaign finance board. These will eliminate from our jurisdiction some of those smaller entities that really do fairly insignificant spending, and yet, as you might guess, it's the smaller, least experienced committees that sometimes cause the most problems and have the require the most staff intervention. I would like to turn then to a discussion of just in general public subsidy programs and the concept behind them, because those are going to be topics for this committee. I don't know if they're even going before the policy committees, but they're not just about budgets. And it really gets to the question the chair posed, is how does our agency contribute to the improvement of Minnesota? I've already indicated, of course, the disclosure component, but there's another component that's working in Minnesota, and it's this whole structure of the campaign finance law that the legislature has created over the years. And that structure relies on limits that can be placed on campaign finance, like contribution limits. You're all familiar with them. It also relies on the concept of voluntarily limiting expenditures. As I mentioned, campaign finance law started in the late 70s, and the first big case which challenged the federal law and by implication Minnesota's law was called Buckley versus Valeo. It's still the most important campaign finance case. That case set forth three things that you really have to recognize in anything you do. One, the court, that court and courts that have followed say money equals speech when it comes to campaigns, because you can't get your message out unless you can spend money. Moving from that, they said, well, then you cannot limit the amount of money that a candidate can use of their own money to promote their election. It's unconstitutional. It violates free speech. And secondly, you can't limit the total that a candidate can spend no matter where it comes from, although you can limit the amount of individual donations to a candidate. And finally, you can require disclosure. And so what Minnesota ended up with is you can limit contributions to a candidate, so we have individual contribution limits. We also have that special source aggregate limit that you all know, the PAC lobbyist large giver limit. So that's part of it. That keeps the money coming in limited from each individual, but not the whole pool. There's no limit on that. And then we opted for a system of limiting spending. And because you can't do that on an involuntary basis, the legislature over the years has crafted a program of public subsidy to make expenditure limits voluntary. So you sign an agreement to limit your spending and to limit your personal contributions. In exchange, the state says it will give you money if you meet certain requirements in the form of public subsidy. That comes in the form of a direct payment to you from the state. It also, at one time, up until a couple years ago, came in the form of a benefit called the Contribution Refund Program, which was really just a different type of public subsidy that allowed an individual donor to get money back. But you still had to sign the public subsidy agreement to get that benefit. Since that benefit's been gone, we have seen a decrease in the use of the public subsidy program. It's not significant. It's a few percentage points from the high 90s to the low 90s, I think. I can't tell you if that's because of the elimination of that program or maybe because candidates just felt that the expenditure limits were too low to abide by and that they could raise enough money to make up for losing that public subsidy. Just a couple comments on what might happen if there were no public subsidy, and I haven't seen a bill yet proposing the total elimination of the program. But take a look at 6th Congressional District, which, of course, maybe is the most extreme example. But as you probably read, the candidates there raised $15 million prior to the election. I don't have the spending figures, but it was pretty close to that. Contrast a House candidate in 15B, which is up in that same general area, and the House candidates altogether spent less than $50,000 for their election. Now, that they all participated in the public subsidy program. Their spending limit was about $35,000 each. None of them spent that much. And because they all participated, they were all bound by the public subsidy agreement. The whole system that Minnesota has established has some surprising, or maybe not surprising, but I think remarkable results. A study was done in the 2006. This was of states that had governors and legislative bodies up for election. 33 states were in the study. In Minnesota, 60% of money raised by candidates came from people who gave $250 or less. That was the most of any of those 33 states, 60%. On the other hand, only 24% of the money came from people who gave $1,000 or more, which was the lowest of any state. So we were the highest in small givers and the lowest in what you might call a large giver. Even more impressive, I think, is that they looked at the percentage of voting age people who donated to candidates, and we were at 4.11%, which was the fourth highest of those 33 states. Part of that might be the contribution refund program. I think a lot of it is the overall disclosure program and the confidence that citizens have in their legislators because of that. If the Campaign Finance Board can continue to provide that level of confidence in the people who are elected or who are running for election, I think we will have done our job, because our job is to be the citizens' eyes into the finances of all of the public officials. I think the last thing I want to say is, how much does this cost? Because that's a big question. The direct public subsidy program that we use to pay you money directly to your campaigns is about $3.5 million per biennium, so every 2 years. What we don't spend, because the governor, for example, isn't up for election every 2 years, there's a certain amount designated per each office, and it carries forward to the next election. So over the long term, $3.5 million per biennium. Contribution refund program, $10 to $12 million per biennium. And by the way, a lot of that money goes to party units, not candidates. The candidates, I didn't have a chance to check my figures, but my recollection is that it's substantially less than half of that money actually goes to candidates as part of the public subsidy program, and the rest goes to party units, including state party units. With that, Mr. Chair, I've concluded, and I'll stand for questions.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Director Goldstein. I have a couple questions for you. You talked about coming forward with a bill that would increase a dollar amount on independent expenditures before they're required to register. What kind of a dollar amount are you considering?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, a case came out of Colorado recently. I believe the case is named the Brumsicle case, but that case challenged limits in a local referendum question, which is very similar to independent expenditures because there's no candidate involved. There can't be any undue influence. In that case, the district court, federal district court, held that a $250 limit was too low, and that was appealed to the Circuit Court of Appeals, who agreed. It's now pending, or they've requested review by the Supreme Court. So we're fairly confident that $250 is probably too low. The board's recommendation is $1,000.
One additional question?
Senator Coleman.
Thank you. That's quite high, but all right. The other question is, I see on your budget summary sheet here that the board members' per diem is increasing in the next biennium. Who decides that, the legislature or the board?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the per diem is set by the legislature and hasn't changed for a long time. It's $55 per day. The reason that we're projecting an increase is because we've been operating for quite a long time with a board of five rather than its full complement of six. So the increase would only be related to the number of members on the board, and the projected amount would be for a full six-member board for the full biennium.
Thank you.
Senator Cohen.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Goldsmith. Do you have any figures? This is more out of curiosity, but do you have any figures both in terms of the contribution refund as well as the public financing portion as to what the breakdown is of Republican versus Democrat versus independent?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, with regard to the direct public subsidy payments, I have the breakdown at my office. I'd be happy to provide that. But I can tell you that with respect to Independence Party candidates, it's quite low because in many races, in fact, most races throughout the state, they don't have a candidate. I would additionally say that the way that program is structured, a portion of the program is what's called the general account. And if you've seen your public subsidy payments, you see that every senator gets the same amount from the general account. Minor parties don't get any money from that account by statute. So they only get the the party account, which is derived from the checkoff on the tax forms. And make sure you're clear on this, that that checkoff on the tax forms is not a taxpayer checking off their own money. They are instructing the Department of Revenue and the Campaign Finance Board to divert $5 or $10 from the general fund of the state to the party of their choice. So it's an allocation system, not a donation system.
But, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Goldsmith,
Senator Cohen,
do you just have approximate figures in terms of the partisan breakdown, if not exact dollar figures?
Mr. Goldsmith.
The approximate figure would be with regard to the public subsidy program itself, the direct payments. They're generally fairly close, not a lot of difference, because both parties tend to run candidates in all the races or as many races as they can. With respect to the contribution refund program, my recollection is that there's a substantial difference. My recollection is that the Republican Party has been more successful in using that program than the Democrats, although it does fluctuate. I would say also with regard to that program, that's a figure. The figure I gave, $10,000 to $11,000, is based on historical standards. That's a program that could be changed by a concerted effort on the behalf of a party to raise money under that program, as could the checkoff program, for that matter.
Pardon me?
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, my experience with the Campaign Finance Board has been a very pleasant one. Anytime we ever had a question, you guys were, guys and gal, all your members of your department were wonderful, so thank you for your good work. I did have one concern, however. In light of budget constraints and the problems that we're going to be facing with our budget over the next biennium, can you explain how it looks like the salary is very, it looks like it's not an across-the-board increase. It looks like some are larger than others, and overall it looks like almost 7% increase over the biennium. Can you explain how you arrived at that and your justification for that?
Mr. Goldsmith. Before you answer, I'm going to let the committee members know that I have asked here on out for all those agencies that will be before us to provide us with a breakout of their employees and their compensation. It is in your packet. I believe that is something that the public deserves to know as well. So go ahead, Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, yes, thank you. These figures actually are taken from projections that Minnesota Management and Budget does. And I think that while I won't dispute their projections, I think their projections are probably on the high side, particularly due to bills that I've seen in the legislature that would limit or eliminate increases for state employees. Their projections, I think, from my reading of them, contemplate the current state employee contracts continuing essentially as they have been, which would include a 1% per year cost of living increase and step increases in one or both years of the contract of about 3.5%. So that would get you into that 7% range. Now, the way to control that from our agency's standpoint is, of course, to negotiate the contracts on terms more favorable to the state. So these are not actually my projections. They're taken directly from Minnesota Management and Budget based on assumptions that I think are more favorable to employees than we're actually likely to see.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
I don't think this is for Mr. Goldsmith, but for you, Mr. Chair. Another thing I think that would be important as we're having these salaries broken down is to also have agencies come before us and tell us how much they're spending on professional technical contractors, because it's very similar to, a lot of agencies have a lot of professional technical contracting going on. A lot of those jobs are not in Minnesota. A lot of those companies, firms that we're hiring to do those jobs are from other states or even other countries. So I think it would be really helpful to have a breakdown of those PT contractors, the number of contractors they have, or actual people, bodies in the job, not just contracts, but bodies in the job, and what their salaries are, what they're being paid, or an average or estimate of what they're being paid by the company they work for. And we'd get a better handle on how many employees or contractors that we have in the state. We could really see where the costs are.
because that's not a line item line item in the budget. So oftentimes we don't know what those costs are as a legislature, and we don't get that broken down for us. So it'd be really helpful if the agencies came forth with that.
Duly noted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair, related to the comment from Senator Goodwin, in addition, it'd be nice to see the actual costs. What were the actual costs for 2010? Not just budgeted numbers, but what were the actuals, maybe 2009, 2010, in the last couple of years to see.
All right. Any other questions? Well, fine job. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Have a great day. Second on the agenda is an overview of the Office of Administrative Hearings. And we have Chief Judge Ray Krause with us, along with the Honorable Eric Lippman, Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Raymond Krause, and I am the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the state of Minnesota, and very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today. With me is Assistant Chief Judge Eric Lippman, who is the Assistant Chief Judge for the Administrative Law Division. If I may begin, the chair has sent in his letter inviting us to appear today to ask some questions that I'd like to frame my presentation around. And the first of those is, what is our mission? In the handout that I believe you have, our mission is to provide settlement conferences, mediation services, and hearing services to state and municipal government programs. And more than that, in a little bit longer explanation of what that mission is basically what we do is provide to the citizens of Minnesota who feel in some way disadvantaged by some decision made by a state agency with highly professional, independent, and less formal access to due process. Our aim is to provide that service in an efficient, centralized, and entrepreneurial manner that's focused on value and quality. Second question is, what can be changed? The next question is, what could be changed at OAH to operate more efficiently? Let me start with, since so many members are new to OAH, start with an overview of what we do and how we are organized and funded. There are three divisions in the Office of Administrative Hearings. The first division is the Administrative Law Division. That division serves over 120 different client agencies and municipalities. The variety of cases that division hears varies widely, from Public Utilities Commission rate cases on rate increase requests from large utilities to licensing cases for daycare, for doctor's licenses, just about any kind of license the state issues, special education hearings, sex offender risk level appeals, municipal boundary disputes, and fair campaign practice complaints, as well as data practice complaints. We also hold municipal ordinance hearings on a contract basis for quite a few cities and counties. The second portion of what the Administrative Law Division does, a very important part, is about rulemaking. And as soon as I'm finished, Judge Lippman will make a short presentation on the rulemaking, so I'll not steal his material. Our budget is a little different than most of the budgets you'll see from state agencies. The Administrative Law Division receives no general fund money, a small part for the campaign cases that comes out of the campaign fund, but for other than that very small bit, we have no general fund monies. We bill for our services on an hourly basis. So if an agency engages us to hold a hearing or a city engages us to hold a hearing, we bill them for our time on an hourly basis. The rate that we use to bill is set by the Minnesota Management and Budget Office. So again, it's a there's a control through the Minnesota Management and Budget Office as to what we can charge on an hourly basis to the clients that use us. You might note, though, our business is increasing largely because the rate that we do charge is well below the average market rate for attorneys in the state of Minnesota. And so as agencies look at doing something in-house, or a city council looks at doing it by hiring an attorney to hold their hearing for them, we end up many times getting that business because we are less expensive than if you hire it that same service outside. The division consists of seven judges, including Assistant Chief Judge Lippman and myself. And between the seven of us, we handle those cases. The second division at OAH is the Workers' Compensation Division. In that division, we conduct hearings, settlement conferences, and mediations in complex cases that involve disputes between an injured worker and employers or insurers. On an annual basis, we resolve over 6,000 cases. In that division, there are 25 workers' compensation judges, including Assistant Chief Judge Tim O'Malley, who is behind me here, and myself. We have an office in Duluth staffed by one full-time judge, and we conduct hearings at four outstate hearing locations in Alexandria, Mankato, Rochester, and Walker. The budget of the Workers' Compensation Division is $14.5 million, all of which comes from the Special Compensation Fund. And again, there is no appropriation from the general fund to for our operations in that division. The third division is the Municipal Boundary Adjustments Unit. The MBA unit administers the state's uniform system of city boundary adjustments. They issue orders for the creation or dissolution of cities, or for the alteration of city borders through consolidation, annexation, or detachment. The unit consists of three staff and an annual appropriation, this one from the general fund, of $267,000. I'd like to now give you some examples of how we accomplish our mission, which is one of the questions the chair asked, how we have contributed to the improvement of Minnesota, and what changes we think would add value to our operation and to state government. First of all, let me say that innovation is not new to OAH. Because OAH has been recognized as a high-quality, low-cost service provider, it has been asked to take on new jurisdiction ever since, in 1974, the OAH was created. Recently, we've been asked to add several new areas of jurisdiction or responsibility. Last year, some of you may remember, we were given authority to hear data practices complaints for an expedited cases. We've taken on recently Minnesota Department of Education food and nutrition service hearings. Just again last year, we were asked to take on Metro Gang Strike Force claims hearings. 3 years ago, the legislature gave us authority to hear Fair Campaign Practice Acts complaints. And that one, I'd like to take just a second to show you, is a very good example of what we're trying to do here. The county attorneys, rather, would get campaign practice cases, and they would get a complaint, and many times the complaint would be filed late in the election cycle, and before the county attorney could get to it, if they got to it at all, the election would be by, and you'd have your opponent saying, oh, look, at Senator so-and-so is under investigation by the county attorney for campaign fraud. And you wouldn't have a resolution to that claim until after the election. Needless to say, this was not a happy situation for many legislators and for the county attorneys. And they went to the legislature and asked that it be shifted away from them to some other entity. And the legislature came to us, asked us if we could do it and how much it would cost. And we worked with the legislature, with this committee and the House version of this committee, and put together a bill that eventually passed, where we turn those cases around on an expedited basis. Now, depending on when they're filed, how close to the election they're filed, within a minimum of 3 days. So the opportunity to make that fair campaign practice complaint and have it out there troubling a candidate until after the election goes away. Because we can turn those around quickly, they're resolved before the election in most cases, and as a result, we've seen the number of cases go down dramatically, and this is all accomplished in recent years by no increase in our staff or our judges. So it was a major piece of new responsibility that's worked out, I think, quite well. That was, however, in the past. The question is, how can we change our agency to better serve Minnesota going forward? I've talked with the chair about a number of suggestions. I think one of the things that this committee could do is look at how to provide caseload relief to additional caseload relief to the judicial branch and other state agencies and see if there is a savings that can be had by shifting things from other agencies to OAH. Again, because of the way we operate and the way we budget, we tend to be the low-cost provider of these due process services, and there might be other opportunities in the coming year to look at what other jurisdiction might make sense for OAH to do. We also see the opportunity to add more cities to the list of those for whom we're conducting hearings. The more cities we contract with, the more broadly we can spread our overhead costs, which then lowers the cost to all the agencies that use us. And so we're actively working with a number of cities to develop city ordinances that would allow them to contract with us to hear their city ordinance violations. The kind that you hear about a lot, the dirty houses, the junk in the piled up in the front yard, those kinds of things. They are finding, city of South St. Paul, for example, and West St. Paul just recently contracted with us, they're finding it's cheaper to use us to hold those hearings than to do it themselves the way they had been doing it. And so we have a day, I think it's Thursdays, is it not?
Third
Thursday right. of the month is South St. Paul Day, and we hear all of those kind of complaints. And again, it's because our rate is set very low, and it makes it cost-effective for them to use us. Second example is the use of contract judges. In the administrative law division, our caseload varies fairly significantly from year to year. And to avoid hiring to the maximum of our potential need, we've hired judges to the minimum of our potential need, and we use contract judges to fill in. So when we have a high demand for services, we pull in some very, very high-quality judges on a contract basis to do these hearings, and then when the demand drops off, we don't have to lay people off, we don't incur those kinds of costs, we just don't use the contract judges, and we go back to just using the full-time judges. So if we don't use them, we don't pay for them. A second benefit to that is if you think about it, if we were doing a daycare licensing case, for example, in Moorhead or Roseau or Luverne, that generally takes 2.5 hours. The travel time from St. Paul for one of our judges to drive to one of those cities and back is going to far exceed the cost of the hearing itself. And so what we have done is we've contracted with contract judges, in Marshall, Alexandria, and Duluth, and Hutchinson, so that the travel time, the agency doesn't pay for as much travel time. And that's a significant savings to the agencies. Unfortunately, we just recently lost our judge in Hutchinson when he changed from being Judge Scott Newman to Senator Scott Newman. So I have to find another one in Hutchinson. But going forward, we are expanding the concept to the workers' comp division in a very limited way. Our workforce is aging dramatically, and we have had a spate of judges leaving either for retirement or for health reasons, and it is very difficult with the time lag for a workers' compensation case to reassign those cases on a sudden basis. And so We've hired now a very, very competent former workers' comp attorney as a contract workers' comp judge who will fill in. For example, we've just had two judges leave for health reasons with no notice at all. And this judge can then step in, pick up those cases, so we don't have to tell an injured worker, I'm sorry, we can't hear your case till next June because everybody's booked up that far. We have this fill-in, if you will, to handle that kind of a case. We also anticipate major changes in the next few years in the area of repurposing staff and using technology. Recent example of what we mean by this is efficient use of existing staff and internal training that we've put on has provided additional support for the workers' compensation judges without additional staff. This means that even with the reduction of total number of judges, we've been able to free up judges to do more hearings while less extensive, or rather expensive, staff handle the work, the routine scheduling work, and the non-judicial work. This, as well as streamlining our internal procedures, has enabled us to reduce our goal of setting a date at which a hearing is held, reducing it from 6 months to 90 days. And that's a fairly significant increase or decrease in time that someone has to wait to get their hearing. We've also been able to reduce the statutory time limit of 60 days to get a decision out to 45 days. So by repurposing and using technology to streamline, we've been able to report our decision times and get those things done faster. We're currently working with the Department of Labor and Industry and the Office of Enterprise Technology to develop an electronic case management system. We anticipate that in the very near future, such a system would provide significant cost savings in postage and paper and result in fewer hands touching every case. But it also means that the injured workers will receive their benefits sooner if they are due any, and insurers will incur less cost in maintaining open case files. It also results in greater accuracy and security for those files. We're looking at innovative ways to reduce our overhead costs. And I'll give you one example from the past that we're going to use in the future. 3 years ago, the Office of Administrative Hearings worked extremely hard to get legislation and budget approval and administrative cooperation to move our offices from commercial space in Minneapolis to our current offices in the Stassen Building. By co-locating with the Department of Revenue at the Stassen Building, we are able to save over $400,000 per year in rent. Just as importantly, though, we worked with the Department of Revenue on a shared services agreement, which resulted in further savings and efficiencies. And frankly, I can tell you, the support we get from the Department of Revenue has really increased our ability to do things in the area of security and technology, human resources, training, that we could never have done on our own as a small agency. But by partnering with them, it becomes cost effective to do those things. Soon, we're going to have the opportunity to use those lessons as we have to move our Duluth office to a new location. Another area of cost reduction for our agency and for the citizens who use our services is video conferencing. We are a leader within the state in encouraging the use of video conferencing for due process hearings. Using video conferencing provides a much more cost-effective way, again, going back to that traveling, we have to bill for that travel time, whereas if it's on a video conference, there's no cost for travel, at least. And for the citizen, it's much more convenient. They don't have to travel to St. Paul or travel to some hub location. They can do it from whatever city they happen to be in. So there again, using technology, we can reduce the cost both for our own agency but also for the citizens who use our services. My last example involves continuous quality improvements. For many years, OAH has used customer surveys with its agency clients and with the parties and members of the bar who appear before us. In the handout that you have in your packet, there's a graph on the back page that depicts the results of these surveys. We're very proud of our results on those surveys, but we use those as continual customer feedback to direct our efforts at total quality improvement. We've also developed an innovative performance management system, which now is modeled, is a model for the OAHs in four or five other states. It's fairly innovative, and it works pretty well. In February, we intend to continue our focus on quality by implementing a legal writing improvement program in cooperation with the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and the Minnesota Tax Court. By partnering with the other courts and having the writing expert who's going to give the lessons appear by video, the cost of this training, and training for our judges is mandatory, is very, very minimal. We're also partnering with the Minnesota Department of Education and the University of Minnesota at Mankato to develop a new innovative special ed training for our judges rather than in the past, because federal regulations require that every year our judges be trained and updated in special ed law, rather than sending them to the conferences in Seattle or Tennessee or California, we're going to be able to do them right here in Mankato. And I think that is a wonderful opportunity that, again, partnering, we couldn't have done it by ourselves, but doing it with the Department of Education and with the university, we're able to do it. The last of the chairman's questions regards lessons for other agencies. We don't profess to be better or more knowledgeable than any other agency, but since the question is asked, I think there are a number of lessons, and I'll give you five that we have learned that might be of value to other agencies as they look at ways to address the challenges in state government. First, I think careful but effective use of contract employees can help manage personnel costs while still maintaining quality service. I think the important words there are careful and effective use. Second, shared services between agencies and taking advantage of co-location can provide many savings and increases in services that are available. And in our case, it actually was a morale booster for our employees. So there were a number of different benefits that we got out of that shared service arrangement with the Department of Revenue. Third, with a little ingenuity, programs for increasing productivity and quality can be developed in-house. Again, partnering is important, but you can do it for very little money and still get the quality training that your staff needs. Fourth, performance management systems don't need to be threatening, but if you design them properly, they can be motivating and really achieve remarkable results. And we have some very remarkable results to demonstrate that. And finally, fifth, I think any agency looking at the challenges that all of us are facing right now needs to maintain a flexible agency mindset. It's a critical element in adjusting to the new challenges, and you need to be willing to be creative, flexible, and look at things in a different way if you're going to adapt to the challenges that are going to be facing our agencies. Those would be my suggestions as things to share with other agencies. At this point, I have finished the presentation. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Senator Olson.
Thank you.
Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Judge Krause, we were just handed an employee roster for
yes.
administrative hearings listing your employees and their salaries, and I just wondered why the judge sitting next to you is managing to draw two salaries. How did he engineer that?
You know, he's a very amazing gentleman, and let me tell you, it wasn't easy to get that done. That's a typo, and we apologize for that. We caught it after we had already sent it to Ms. DeBeck, so forgive us for that.
Mr. Vice Chairman and Senator Olson, I'm on a leave of absence from my classified position to serve as assistant chief, the head of the division, which is an unclassified spot. And so in the records of MMB, they have my former position still listed. I'm not taking two salaries, I promise, even though I'm in this unclassified spot. If If that unclassified spot were to end, I would return to the classified service.
Mr. Chair, I thought somebody might like to have an opportunity to clarify that before we.
Thank you. I'm very grateful.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. Chief Judge, I want to ask you about the contract judges. They're not on here, I assume, on your list. And, you know, I would like that list very much. If you could give me a list of your contract judges and how much they're being paid annually, or they were paid last year for the ones that you have, that would be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, I'd be happy to provide that. They don't draw a salary. We pay them on an hourly basis for each case that they do. So
okay.
It'll be we have those numbers very easily. We can get those to you for all of the contract judges.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, a question along the lines of overlap between the work comp division and the other offices. The work comp statute is a very complex set of rules and regulations and statutes that require a fair amount of practice and expertise. Are the judges hearing work comp cases now all exclusively work comp judges, or are they doing other kinds of cases as well?
Chief Judge Cross.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, all of our full-time judges are workers' comp judges who do nothing but workers' comp. Our administrative law judges are the administrative law cases. We have one of our administrative law judges who used to be a member of the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, and so is quite qualified to do workers' comp cases, but generally doesn't except in an emergency. The one contract judge that we've just hired to do workers' comp cases is exceptionally qualified. As a matter of fact, we have a press release going out on him. He's been working in the field for 18 years in workers' comp and teaches in the area and is extremely qualified. So for workers' comp cases, with the rare exception when we can't avoid it and we have to pull in one of the administrative law judges who used to be on the Court of Appeals, we don't cross over. The statute does give us authority to do that, but it hasn't been necessary, and so we haven't done it until very recently when we had a number of people leaving with no notice, and we were kind of stuck.
Thank you.
I'll take one more question. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chief Judge, thank you for your innovative strategies that you're using to reduce the cost of your services. They are similar to the strategies that the private sector is using, and it's very encouraging to hear that you're working so hard to find ways to spend our taxpayers' money efficiently and effectively. We really appreciate it. I had a question relating to the municipal boundary units. How many of those types of situations do we have annually or in a 10-year period? Are they many? What are some of the criteria that are used in evaluating whether to move forward? What is the public's opportunity to join you in the conversation about what is happening?
Chief Judge Cross.
Chairman, Senator Lilly, that's a very good question. As far as how many there are, we have dozens and dozens of annexations or what they call orderly agreements, where both the township and the city agree, or the citizen landholder agrees with the city on changing the boundary in some way. That municipal boundary adjustment unit handles those as kind of a ministerial thing. Since all the parties agree, there's nothing to hold a hearing about. So they just handle those and get that paperwork done so that people know what district they're voting in, and Department of Transportation knows which roads to plow and those kinds of things. For those that are not an orderly annexation agreement where there's some controversy about it, the first step is that unit tries to get the parties to mediate. If mediation fails, then they send it to the Administrative Law Division to hold a hearing. And the criteria for making the decision and the process by which one holds those hearings is set in statute. and we hold public hearings, and generally, I can't think of an instance when there was a limit, but the citizens of the area are allowed to participate to the extent that they feel they want to, and some of these cases are very controversial, as you may know, and some of them, I've been in some, I've held some of these hearings that go on till 11, 12 at night with people wanting to view, give their views on an annexation or a detachment or something. That does happen, and we accommodate that. That's part of the process as we see it, is to let, again, it's due process. It's getting the citizens the right and the ability to have their voice heard. That's all put into the record, and that is then taken back by the judge and considered in making the decision against the criteria that are set in statute.
Chief Judge Krause, on behalf of this committee and all the citizens of the state of Minnesota, thank you. Thank you for your innovative efforts, your leadership to create these efficiencies that you mentioned this afternoon and to facilitate speedy justice. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
So next, we'll move on to this next agenda item, and that is a presentation on rulemaking by the Office of Administrative Hearings by Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge Eric Lipman.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, members. What every member should know about rulemaking. I'd like to start the presentation at the end. What every member should know about rulemaking is that it's a part of effective self-government, that the delegations of rulemaking authority to state executive branch agencies really, really does matter. When rulemaking does occur, we rely upon the wisdom of the group. And Minnesota's approach to rulemaking, while complicated, I'm going to try to argue today that it yields better substantive results than the alternatives. So let's start at the very first day of session. Senate Rule 4.5 conferred upon this committee an important gatekeeper function that for all bills delegating rulemaking or exempting a department from rulemaking has to make a stop here at the Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans before moving on to the floor. And so this is an important protection that the Senate provides to reside, an important trust, really, that it resides with this committee to be the rulemaking experts and to be the gatekeepers over delegations in favor of state agencies. And you play a really pivotal role. And so that's why we're glad to have this opportunity to talk about our role in rulemaking and also to give whatever briefing we can and an early invitation that we're glad to provide technical support or background information to members as they perform this very important function. Let me go back 200 years, if I could. Mr. Jefferson's writing from his desk on Market Street in Philadelphia, and he says that we're endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights, and that with those rights, governments are instituted amongst men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So this is where we start in the entire process. If we were to put it out graphically, the Creator is on the left. The Creator makes a delegation to whom? Who's in the next picture?
Voters.
Creator makes, you know, we are endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights. There's a delegation to, who are those good-looking people there in the third picture?
Must be the Senate.
Must be the Senate. Those very good-looking people. And then what we're talking about here today is a further delegation. And the reason why it's important and why Senate Rule 4.5 exists is there's frequently delegations in favor of state executive departments. Let me talk about two different office spaces. The very good-looking people on the left have a delegation directly from the voters, who have one from God, or at least so says Mr. Jefferson. And they're on television. They're doing things in public on Channel 17. And they have election certificates, and so they are duly authorized. But Office Space B, where rulemaking drafting might well occur, is not on television by folks who don't stand for election, don't have election certificates, do so out of the public eye, are not known necessarily to interested stakeholders. And so having folks in Office Space B undertake a lawmaking function, which is to draft and promulgate regulations, is conditioned in certain important ways by the folks in Office Space A. The strings that we attach to delegations of rulemaking authority are several. There's a public notice process in rulemaking. There's the detail of what we call the SONAR, the statement of need and reasonableness. Executive branch agencies have to detail their reasons for promulgating a particular rule. We require agencies to do an affirmative presentation of facts. We don't just take an executive branch agency's word for it. They have to prove it up. There's an independent legal review by the judges of OAH to make sure that the requirements of the law have been met. And there's also a gubernatorial veto, again, another condition on these items. So the folks in Office Space B can't just go off and do whatever it is they like. There are significant strings attached to any exercise of those powers. The current legislative consensus is that we can improve oversight and accountability and uniformity in rules and the access by members of the public, and also to increase public participation if we have the kind of admittedly complex but rulemaking procedures that we have in Chapter 14. So again, just to drill down a little further, just to take out the verbs, oversight, accountability, uniformity, and public access and participation, these are the things that we get, admittedly, through the price of a little bit more a complicated process. For any folks who have ever read Chapter 14, it is complicated, but I think it does indeed have these benefits. And indeed, in the first part of Chapter 14, the legislature says, while we're only conferring procedural rights in this system, we're only telling people how it is that they can do things, we're not saying exactly what has to be done, we have the expectation that if we do it in this way, we'll have better substantive results, that the product, the end product, is better at the end of all of this complexity. And I agree. I think we do have better substantive results. We believe in the wisdom of the group. If we can engage the public on all of these things and have their best thinking, we can have a better substantive rule rather than just the folks in Office Space B writing it on their own without talking to anyone else. So how we engage the group is with the SONAR, the Statement of Need and Reasonableness. There's an analysis of each of the rules that are proposed, and it's circulated. And there's a time period for folks who might be interested in having a broader set of public inputs to request a hearing, at least 30 days, and to submit their own views. What's in the SONAR? A description of who will be affected, the cost to government agencies, whether there are less costly and less intrusive alternatives, whether there might be other ways of doing it, what are the probable costs of complying, the costs of not doing anything at all, that's an important consideration. And an assessment of any differences between the rule that's proposed and any federal regulations. So if a hearing is requested, the statement of need and reasonableness and any exhibits, any support that the agency has in order to justify the proposed rule, and then we go out and we get oral evidence. Interested persons can come and testify, ask questions of the people who are proposing the rules from the agency panel, and there's a dialogue back and forth. And then the administrative law judge makes a report based upon a sort of, it's not nearly as formal as a trial, it's more like a city council hearing or a zoning commission hearing. What are the benefits of the system? Well, we have two different courthouse models, two different litigation models. The one on the left is a very handsome building just to our left, the Minnesota Judicial Center. If we were to look in the annals of state administrative law, there's probably a handful of cases following a dispute about rulemaking in our process. I'm thinking somewhere between six and a dozen. Courthouse B is the courthouse on Constitution Avenue in Washington, the house of the home of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, and that's where all the challenges to federal rules go. I stopped counting at 500 reported cases. Okay. And so the reasons the difference in the model is that much of our procedural regularity is baked into the cake in the front end of the state system. We have an independent legal review. We have a detailed set of reasons. We have the gubernatorial veto. We have a public hearing process which can be quickly prompted by those folks who are interested in. Those features are not present in federal rulemaking. They do have to do notice and comment, but the agencies in the federal system have a much greater swath or range of discretion to promulgate rules, and they end up getting sued later. I think that there are benefits to avoiding litigation and to having the best product of the rules up front. And again, that's part of the independent legal review. Having that an early process before we get a rule, I think, ensures that the reasonableness and the non-arbitrariness of executive branch rules more often than it does in the federal system, and also avoids all of that litigation. Just by way of review, a familiar percentage in our division is that we're finding legal defects in proposed rules at about 40% of the time. Okay? So OAH is really a value add, having that independent legal review, because I think very much the alternative is resort to Courthouse B, and it can be a very expensive and unwelcome alternative for state agencies. So I think we are a real value add in that respect. So a quick recap. I think rulemaking is an effective part of self-government. It allows the Senate to focus on the large policy questions because it can make a delegation and then leave some of the technical details to be set out in a rulemaking process, but also to involve interested stakeholders and members of the public. Okay, it's not just set off to the agency and to let them decide. The scope of the delegation, whether you want a wide swath of authority for the executive branch agency or a fairly narrow one, really is an important question, and it's an important question that the Senate rules puts first and foremost to this committee. You are the gatekeepers on delegations. When we do rulemaking, when one is set out, we rely upon the wisdom of the group. We're eager to have folks involved. Part of the process is to have a very vigorous public notice plan for folks to actually go out and search for folks who might well be interested in the proposed rules and try and find them. That's one of the legal pieces of the legal review that I and the other judges of the division do to make sure that they're making those advertisements. And while our approach is complex, I think that to the extent that we can clean up rules and eliminate defects before they're promulgated and to avoid later litigation costs, notwithstanding the fact that our system is probably more complex than the federal system, I think we get better substantive results. And so, mindful of the hour, that was what I was eager to tell members, and we're glad, of course, to stand for questions.
Members, any questions? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge Lipman, I have thought about for a number of years about the need to incorporate some mechanism to make the rule process, the rule creation process, and monitoring the rule process. And I don't know if you have internally a way of reviewing this. Let me give you an example. I worked for the Department of Human Services for a number of years, and in 1998, a group of people came before the legislature to review the rules for children that govern the placement of children in out-of-home placement, whether that's a correctional facility, a foster home, et cetera. And in that process, they discovered that we had a number of rules impacting those different programs, but they, overall, what they did was really look at the placement of children. So whether it was a correctional facility or a foster home, they were basically doing the same thing. So the legislature assigned corrections and DHS to come together to look at all the rules governing those aspects of placement. Well, I ran for the Senate in 2006, and the so-called umbrella rule was not done. So that's 7 years in the making. And it was a process of reviewing the rules and making it simpler so that any correctional facility or foster home will know the process and will know what the rules say. Tremendous bureaucracy, tremendous, you know, amount of work. And I don't know what happened, really. I don't know if we actually do have an umbrella rule. But at the time, you know, for 7 years of reflection, I thought, how do we incorporate into the system, a system that reviews that, that if we are creating rules that overlap and govern similar areas, who is overseeing this so that we simplify this? And how do we have that in place so that we are ongoing, you know, kind of monitoring that process of really simplifying our rule-making process.
Assistant Chief Judge Lipman.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, I think we're the second part of that process. The first part of the process, as far as inspiring reform, regulatory reform, really is in this committee and I think the Hahn Committee. I think that if you were to write letters, particularly on your Senate stationery, to the Department of Corrections and say, we established this task force many years ago, we'd be eager to have an oversight hearing on your progress, that, I think, tends to focus, as someone who used to work in still works in the executive branch. If we were to get a letter like that from the Senate and to come and explain, I think that that prompts the kind of work that you're hoping to has happened. Where our role at OAH is that once there is a set of reforms done, we compare the underlying statute to the work that's completed and to make sure that all of the procedural steps and that that the agency has promulgated a rule that's within its authority. So we're checking their math, and that's the role and the value add that we provide. Actually getting an agency to complete its homework, I think that that's probably more the oversight committees, because, again, we're not in a policymaking role. We're just making sure that they've followed the law as part of our independent legal review. I hope that that answers the question.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tursri.
Not actually, because I think what I'm referring to is in your presentation, you had this graphic that says, you know, the voter, the legislature, and you over there doing this, but you have, you know, this process that that we somehow the public influences.
Mm-hmm.
So there is where this process of rulemaking actually takes place. And my question is, do we have a way of monitoring how this rule creation actually is done in a way that is simpler? It seems like, you know, in the case that I described to you, you know, 7 years reviewing something
right.
that grew over time. I wish we had a way of monitoring that through your office, through your, you know, the existing process to say, well, we're about to create a rule that we kind of already have. And so how do we go about making that known to the public and to us so that a rule that is similar is not created again because the statute was created and then now we need to have a new rule that speaks pretty much about the same thing. So I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but I wish there was a – I don't know if you think that is of value to have an existing monitoring mechanism that gives a warning of here comes another rule that is about the same thing, expanding something we already had and kind of making the system more – the ruling system more complex.
Judge
Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres, right. Again, I think that these are best functions because you have the widest palette on which to create – by the oversight committees. The Hahn Committee, let's just say, if they were to bring in an agency witness, they say they could have a number of alternatives. We are going to promulgate X rule. We want you to stop your task force on Y rule, if that's the problem. We'd like you to report by the end of the fiscal year on your progress on your reform. There's a wide range of options, whether they could do it themselves, whether they could repeal, whether they could oblige a report, whether you know, it's an oversight hearing, whether it's a confirmation issue, all of these types of things. I think that the oversight committees are in the best position to inspire the behavior that you hope for. I agree with you that sounds like a long time.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to move on to the next item here. We're about 5 minutes before the end. Judge Lippman, thank you for your presentation. Our third item on the agenda is the final item on the agenda is committee action on the appointment of Raymond Krause to the Office of Administrative Hearings, Chief Administrative Law Judge. This appointment was submitted during the 2010 session. Some of you were here and vetted this appointment. It went to the Senate floor, but was one of those that did not get acted on due to time, as it's been explained to me. I talked with Senator Rest about that. And so it is being resubmitted for the committee's consideration. And with that, would like to have Chief Judge spend a few minutes talking about, of course, your background and your accomplishments and anything else you would like the committee to consider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I appreciate the opportunity. As you saw in the overview that we presented, we've done a lot of things in the last 6 years. I think we have been mindful of trying to be as efficient but also as fair as possible in providing these due process services. I still think, though, there's a lot yet to be done. We have a number of projects in the works. I'm very excited about the possibility of providing more caseload relief, of getting our case management system online. We've just implemented email notice for workers' comp cases, and we're getting a flood of compliments from the bar about doing our notices by email rather than paper, which took longer, had to have more staff to deal with it than they do now, and so everybody seems to have benefited. The idea of branching out and having more services for municipalities is another thing that I think very much involved in and very interested in, and I'd like to pursue. In order to keep up the momentum and capitalize on our ongoing improvements, I believe stability in the management at OAH is important. In our history, since the creation of OAH in 1974, we've only had one judge actually stay through two full terms. And I think that lack of stability over the years has inhibited the agency from doing all it could do. I think there's a lot of untapped potential there, and I think we can get a lot done in the next 6 years if I am continuing on as chief judge. As far as my background, I think you have the papers in your book. I won't go into that in any great detail, but I graduated from Georgetown University and Georgetown University Law School. I worked in the private sector for the Pillsbury Company for a number of years. I left there to become the dean of Hamline University Law School, and then was tapped by Governor Carlson to go on the Minnesota Tax Court. I served there for a little over 4 years, and was asked by Governor Pawlenty to come over to the Department of Revenue as Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy until he then asked me to come over and take over OAH, and so I did that 6 years ago. It's been a great honor to have this position. I take it very, very seriously. I have tried very hard to maintain good relationships with the legislature on both sides of the aisle and with all the constituent groups that we serve. And I hope the record speaks for itself, and I'd very much appreciate your support for confirmation.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I would like to, before I open it up for any questions, I would like to also, I didn't before the judge gave his statements, mention that last year the committee did recommend to confirm this appointment. So now you have all the information from last year. So questions, Senator Wigan.
Well, Mr. Chair, I had made the motion last year to recommend his reappointment, but if there are members with questions, new members, I would wait.
Right. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't on this committee last year, so wasn't involved with any discussions involving Judge Krause, and this is not directed against the judge nor his competency, but I am concerned about the process because I think it is an unusual one, and for that reason we'll oppose the confirmation. As the chair indicated, and let's see if I got my dates correct, if I have them listed correctly, the Senate received the notice of appointment from Governor Pawlenty on April 7th. The committee action, I believe, was on April 19th. No action was taken. Well, in between now and then, there's been an intervening event, and that is the election of a new governor. I'm not aware in the history of the state, and I had asked Mr. Bodern earlier, he's not sure. We don't have information, but having been around here for a while, and Sarah Olson, I'll defer to you. I don't recall in the transition from Governor Perpich, a Democrat, to Governor Carlson, a Republican, in 1990 to 1991, that the Democratic Senate took up any carryover confirmations of Governor Perpich. Instead, we left everything as an open book for the new governor, Governor Carlson. It could well be that that Judge Krause would be resubmitted by Governor Dayton, but there is a new governor, and I think to pick up holdover confirmations is an unwise precedent. Now, there's no question that there are unusual. This is a unique situation to the extent that I believe, and again, I'll defer to Mr. Bodern, that most confirmations have held over because members who were present last year will recall that we did not confirm Commissioner McElroy, I think Commissioner Sfigema, there might have been a couple of other commissioners. And so many of those appointments are end with the end of the particular governor's term. There's no question that the action proposed by the chairman in this regard is legally correct, but I think it does raise concerns where you do have this transition. And to be honest, you know, just in terms of the partisan balance, how much discussion have we had about, you know, a changeover in the Senate majority and minority, the fact that we haven't had a Democratic governor in 20 years? So certainly in the context of some unusual circumstances, this is it. But I do think it sets an unwise precedent. And I do not believe, and to be honest, Sarah Olson, please correct me if I'm wrong, back 20 years ago, I wasn't chairman of anything in this place, but I don't.
Was I?
but I don't recall that the Senate majority, then majority, a Democratic majority, picked up any leftover confirmations of Governor Perpich. Now there have been differences with board appointments, but I do think this is unique.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just a process question. We're 5 minutes, or now we're overtime here, taking up this confirmation last 5 minutes. I wasn't on this committee last year either. I'm certainly very impressed with Judge Krause in his, I just received this today, and we've heard the presentation of the office, very impressed. But I think we just found out that we're going to be taking this up about a day ago. And I haven't had the benefit of hearing from other folks either informally in my office or in this forum in a public hearing setting. I may well vote for Judge Krause, but wondering about the process and allowing enough time to consider this appointment.
I was reminded, I was trying to remember last year, but I was reminded that we probably spent less time on it last year than we are right now with this. And I understand it does have one more step to go, and that will be to the Senate floor and can be duly vetted between now and then or even on the Senate floor when we get to that point. Any other questions?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've been around this process for 25 years, but I haven't been in the Senate, so I haven't been under the confirmations, and I too am concerned. I haven't had enough time. This is the first time I've ever met him, and in fact, I think he lives in the district I represent, so that's a great thing, and I appreciate having such a a distinguished person in the district. But I do think that we do, I would like to know much more, and I am concerned if I was the governor, which will never happen, and I'm not going to run for it, but if I was, I certainly would like to have a letter in here from Governor Dayton saying that he approves of this. He has, that's right now his responsibility and his under his power to make those decisions, and he may well be supportive of Judge Krause, I don't know, but I would really like to know that one way or the other before I vote on it. I would want to make sure that the Senate wasn't confirming people that I hadn't yet made the decision on. So I think we need to take that into consideration, have a little more time for hearing, and also talk to the governor about what he prefers.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I appreciate that there is another step, and that's the floor, but this, you know, the work of the committee is the work of the committee, and it's the proper role of the committee to have public hearings where we take perhaps public testimony. I don't know if anyone is going to step forward to make any statements for the record in favor of the judge's confirmation or in opposition, but that might be the case. That wouldn't be available to anyone if we were to simply move this out of committee today onto the floor.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen was trying to, he's inferring accurately that I have been around here longer than he has, but I have not been in the majority. There have been a whole variety of vagaries to a confirmation process that I have witnessed over these years, some that I would rather forget, and maybe that's why I don't remember all of the details of this whole process. But I think I can't remember a confirmation hearing that gave us an opportunity to have a more thorough review of a person's performance and what they've accomplished. And going forward, I would have no problem with this being sent onto the floor. I believe, Senator Cohen, you mentioned that you knew of no legal problem with it. And I think that does give us some time in terms of if somebody wants to discuss it with the governor or have any other further examination of it, I think there's time to do that, and I think this committee has done a very good job of essentially learning more about the work of this judge and considering what it might be like to have him continue in that role for another term. So I would hope that we would take the action and move it forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
I don't want Mr. Olson to take any undue inference from my comments. It was meant more as a matter of respect to Senator Olson. But I raised some process concerns, but I think, and to be honest, Mr. Chairman, it's by virtue of having chaired the Finance Committee over the last number of years, I got kicked off of all my policy committees when we had, the divisions generally separate. My policy chairman were upset that I never showed up, so they said stay away. So I haven't been around the confirmation process within the committee, the policy committees, for a while. And I'm glad that Senator Dibble raised the question relative to just process, a chance to get to know Judge Cross or anybody else. I mean, we're going to have a slew of confirmations from Governor Dayton, obviously. And what's often been the case that I recall is, the new commissioners, judges, whatever, would make the rounds of committee members. I'm a little bit surprised that new committee members and new members of the Senate would not want the opportunity to have a confirmation process. And I think, Senator Dibble, that's what you were talking about, was a process that has often been the case where within the policy committee, and I'm glad you kind of reminded me of my older days here, where the Commissioner X would show up so that before the committee hearing took place, with the confirmation on the agenda, we'd have a chance to ask questions or have a better sense of the individual. And that doesn't suggest then that Judge Krause or anybody else, because Mr. Chairman, you'll have, confirmations of admin, all sorts of agencies will be in this committee for confirmation. And I fully expect that new members of the committee would want the opportunity, new members in particular, would want the opportunity to get a chance to know the nominees, the governor, and I think the same is true here.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Judge Krause, I'm glad you're here and you're willing to go through this process. You've been an incredibly good administrator through that department over the last 6 years, and many of us have worked with you here at the Capitol for many years, including Senators Cohen and Olson and Dibble in your various roles. And I think you come with incredible credentials, and what's more, you come with a track record of great experience. And so I'm ready to vote, but there may be others here that might like to look a little more, and perhaps that's an opportunity here, but I don't want anyone to think that any delay here on the part of this committee might be anything other than our due diligence here. But I, for one, am ready to support Judge Krause. He's done an incredible job. He comes with impeccable credentials, and I don't think anyone could do better representing the state of Minnesota and the interests that he does. So thank you.
Senator Daley.
I would definitely echo the sentiments of Senator Ortman, and taking into consideration all of the other comments and concerns. Mr. Chair, I move that the committee recommend the confirmation of Raymond Kraus for the Office of Administrative Hearings Chief Administrative Law Judge.
Senator Daley moves that the committee recommend the confirmation of Raymond Kraus for the Office of Administrative Hearings Chief Administrative Law Judge. All those in favor,
Chair?
Say aye.
Mr. Chair? Question?
Senator Wigan.
I did speak in behalf of Judge Kraus and mentioned I had, I'm aware of his work, and I believe he's very professionally competent. He responds, has put together an effective team. I have not heard from the Dayton administration on this, and I don't know if they have someone here. It's been silent. Maybe they've talked to some other members. That said, with Senator Ortman, I appreciate very much what you said, and I thought you were going to follow that lead, Senator Daley, about due diligence for some of those members that might want more information, and also because of the new administration, that there be a chance to weigh in. It's not to unduly procrastinate, but to provide a window for that opportunity. So that said, I would, in good